This message comes from NPR sponsor MassMutual. The Financial Educators Council says 39% of Americans don't have someone to go to for financial advice, but you can plan for the short and long term with someone backed by 170 years of financial expertise at MassMutual.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. In 2010, Deborah Granick made a movie called Winter's Bone. It was sort of a modern film noir, except instead of being set in L.A. or New York, it was set in the Ozarks in Missouri. And instead of a gumshoe and a fedora, it followed a 17-year-old girl as she pieced together the story behind her father's disappearance. Ree Dolly, that's the girl, walked through burned-out meth labs, negotiated with crime families, bail bondsmen, and cops. It was a small movie, a lot of dialogue, a lot of beautiful exterior shots, and a modest budget. And I mean, you probably already know this, but Ree Dolly was played by an actress named Jennifer Lawrence. It was her first ever starring role. Lawrence's performance was great, but it's not the only reason Winter's Bone was nominated for Best Picture that year. Deborah Granick got the tone perfectly. It's quiet where it needs to be. The dialogue is sparse and plain spoken, but the drama keeps you watching, rapt. The characters, some of the poorest, most underserved people in the country, are complex, relatable people. It talks as much about family and love as it does the dark underbelly of the Ozarks.
The law came bad today. Dad signed over everything to his bond. Victoria, I really gotta run Dad down to get him to show.
You ought not do that. Don't go running after Jessup. Show or don't show, that choice is up to one that's going to jail, not you.
You know where he's at, don't you?
Where a man's at ain't necessarily feuding known either.
But you do.
I ain't seen him.
Could be running around with little Arthur and them, you think?
Don't you ever go down around Little Arthur's asking them people about they ain't offered to talk about. That's a real good way to end up bit by hogs. Or wishing you was.
When I talked with Deborah last year, she'd just finished the long-awaited follow-up to Winter's Bone. It's called Leave No Trace. Like Winter's Bone, it puts a compelling but compassionate focus on marginalized groups. One of the principal threads is a combat veteran's struggle with trauma and homelessness. It tells the story of a father and daughter who live entirely off the grid in a nature reserve not far from Portland, Oregon. Then the dad gets arrested and social workers get involved, offering housing, work, school. But as you might imagine, it's a tough transition for both of them. Look, I'm just going to say this. Leave No Trace is a beautiful work of art. The LA Film Critics Association called it the best film of the year. Deborah is nominated for Best Director at the Independent Spirit Awards. There is lots of great stuff in this conversation you're about to hear, but if you come away with one piece of information, I want it to be this. Go see Leave No Trace. Anyway, here's a little bit of the film. The opening scenes detail regular life for Will and his daughter, Tom. They forage and cook mushrooms. Will teaches Tom to play chess. They build fires for warmth. And in this scene, they're inside a tent, and it's raining outside as they get ready to go to sleep.
What's your favorite color?
What's yours?
Yellow. What was my mother's favorite color?
Yellow.
Maybe she taught me that. I wish I could remember.
She would have wished for that, too. Get some sleep. Good night, Yellow.
Deborah Granick, welcome to Bullseye. I'm glad to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I heard that you were a wedding videographer for a long time. Is that true?
I did do that. That's how I made my sort of daily wage or weekly wage in Boston. I was living there at the time. And yes, I did do that.
What are the secrets to high-quality wedding videography besides knowing how to operate the equipment?
Well, I used to like, you know, it was there's a lot of anthropology in weddings, and weddings, different ethnic groups, different classes, social class, where they're held, the poignancy of weddings, you know. So my wedding videos were not very conventional in that way because, you know, I was very interested in, like, the, you know, ECU and the comedy of, like, not being able to put something on the lapel, you know. I loved photographing, you know, the elders, the people's grandparents and stuff. And so I had to be very careful that I at least got the vows in there as well, you know. And yeah.
You've made films about people who do not share your background. Was that always your intent?
Yeah, I think it's, for some filmmakers or for some people, it's very hard to reflect on the things that are close. You know, it's the distance, it's the unfamiliar that allows for, like, almost, I want to say, more replete note-taking or more noticing things more. As much as I've wondered what it would be like to try to turn the camera on my own family or on places and kind of lifestyle things that I know well, I've just always found it hard. And whereas when I don't know how things are done and the practices that I'm seeing and the why of everything, it's in stronger relief, and it feels like there's something there to film. Whereas I'm inured to my own, you know, my own whatever practices, you know.
I want to ask you a question about this anthropological perspective. You know, you can go up into the mountains and talk to folks who live there to get a sense of what it's like to, you know, live next to a meth lab or have, you know, a culture where there's always a guitar or a banjo at hand. Like, there's a lot of things that you can directly perceive to make Winter's Bone, your movie that came out 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Leave No Trace is a movie that is based on a novel that's based on a true story about which we don't know very much. It's about a father and daughter who lived by themselves in a park in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
And you can't go and ask them what that's like. So how do you get a sense of what those feelings are when it isn't a place that you can go to and ask people?
Right. Well, so then that's when fiction and anthropology become collaborators, right? Or they you know. So then if you create the given circumstance, let's say you know a blueprint, like you say, that you know the park that they lived in, and you know that they obtained most of their food from a very ordinary grocery store using a very modest budget of very small VA benefits, disability benefits that were at a very low percentage. And so you've got these facts. So you don't know what they purchased. And you know, and then, but that's what the marriage of fiction. You know, we were in that grocery store. It made sense that they ate eggs. It turned out that that was something we could cook on, you know, in our set, that once the fire was built, it was easy to boil eggs. It's really a lot of bang for your buck nutritionally, you know. We're also in the grocery store, and Thomason, who's playing the character, Tom, she, in one of the takes, picked up a bag of mandarins, you know, just a mesh bag of mandarins, and asked her father right there and then, can we get these? And he was going to either nod yes or no. It was either going to be saying that they could afford or they couldn't. The anthropology in this instance could only go so far. If the article had said that they had a mono diet of only medium grain brown rice and beans, I would have been intrigued by that, and I probably would have shown that. But then Thomason may have said, you know, we always have rice and beans in a rehearsal. Can we get tangerines, you know? And I would have been very interested. I would have been very interested in what this teen actress is bringing from her own impulse as well. And in a rehearsal setting, I may have taken note of that and then wanted to add that to the script. Because the anthropology now becomes about this teen. And she's got a craving, and she's and it's okay to ask, you know? Can we get it? So my drift here is some details are going to be laid out in the text or in the original document, and they're going to get married to what that grocery store really has, and then subsequent to that, what the teen actor might spontaneously want to mix into the rehearsal. And so it goes.
In the real-life story, the girl who was living in a big urban park in Portland with her dad was 13 years old, I remember, right?
Yeah.
The actress who plays her in your film is, I guess, probably a couple years older.
Yes.
But certainly could, you know, certainly could pass for 13 in movie world. Was that age and part of life of particular interest to you?
You know, I think it was important that she was young enough that the forest was still her classroom and that her imaginary world was still functioning, and that she could conjure things and be engrossed in, you know, the world around her in a way that was very focused. I think she's learning at a pretty rapid rate, I would say, that something disturbs and, I would say, unbalances her father, you know. And yet she can't be so all-knowing that she's got it wrapped up and has all the vocabulary for that. So I think the fact that she's on the younger side allows for this believable process of observation, of piecing things together, of forging your connections. And I did like that about her. It allows me to use that a lot as a visual technique. What is Tom seeing? And what is she inferring from it? What questions does she have? By those questions, we will learn what is it she needs to know. And we'll also learn a little bit more about her father and what she desires.
Your film, Leave No Trace, is based on a novel by Peter Rock called My Abandonment.
Yes.
Is the novel's protagonist also the daughter, as it is in your film? I mean, I think that there are two central characters in your movie, but we very much see through the daughter's eyes. Was that the case in the book?
It is the case in the book. In the book, the father has more psychiatric issues going on than we, you know, than we depict, meaning I really wanted Will to also be a reliable character, meaning that that his perception and brain functioning is not so different from ours that there's no point of recognition or congruency. And in the book, he suffers from more things, you know, that his hypervigilance has led him move more along the spectrum of extreme paranoia, and he becomes less relatable. But in the novel, the daughter, absolutely, she is the narrator. She is the one that is observing her father. She is the one that is stepping in and translating in some ways for her father, more so than in the film. In the film, it is more of a dialogue between them, whereas in the book, given that it's first person, it's she's the protagonist. Because she's the only person you can really feel that you understand.
Why did you choose to have Will, the father, have a more recognizable psychiatric state, something that felt more like, more relatable to folks who don't have any mental illness?
I would say that why I did that was because I wanted people not to dismiss him. I didn't want... It is so convenient to say... And we have all this pejorative language, right? Nut job, weirdo, you know, clinically this, clinically that. You know, I like the idea that in the DSM, he was hard to pinpoint because part of his stuff is utterly volitional. You know, what would you say about Henry David Thoreau? Would you say he's got defiance disorder? He's grandiosity because he wants to philosophically contemplate what it means to live with less, you know. I mean, I didn't want him to be dismissed and for us not to care. I wanted to make some of the things that he was striving for and questioning worthy of our attention and for us to care that he would get some of what he needs. So if he's unrelatable or dismissible, that's never going to happen.
We'll finish up my interview with Deborah Granik when we return from a quick break. Still on the docket, She's working on a film based on the book Nickeled and Dimed, which, if you haven't read it, is a thoroughly investigated, brilliant work of nonfiction. She'll tell me how she plans to turn that into a narrative film. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor REI. REI believes that a life outdoors is a life well lived, and they have for 80 years. So check out their podcast, Wild Ideas Worth Living, for inspiring stories of people and of taking the road less traveled. Hear from explorers, athletes, authors, and experts in the field. Follow how they're taking wild ideas and making them a reality every day. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Oscar season, and we don't want you to show up on the red carpet unprepared. That's why Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help you sort through the nominees and separate the best from the rest. Check us out on Friday, and let us try to help you dominate your Oscar pool.
Unless you binge-watch TV at least 80 hours a week, Inside Pop is definitely not for you.
Sean, that's a little extreme, and also not quite true.
Okay, Amita, how about Inside Pop is the podcast for people who love and appreciate the best pop culture has to offer.
Oh, much better.
In every episode, we interview the people who create the culture you crave.
Past interviews include the showrunner of Ava DuVernay's Queen Sugar and Mudbound director Dee Reese.
You'll also get the very best pop culture recommendations in our Big Sell segment.
Plus the opinions of two TV producers who are pop culture obsessives and actually do binge 80 hours of TV a week.
Eyeballs. So tired.
Listen to Inside Pop every other Wednesday on the Maximum Fun Podcast Network.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest Deborah Granick wrote and directed the acclaimed 2010 film Winter's Bone. When we talked last year, she just released her long-awaited follow-up to that film. It's called Leave No Trace. You can stream it now on Amazon. Ben Foster, who's one of the stars of the film, gave a quote, and I'm paraphrasing in an interview that he did about the movie. He said that being on set with you was very intense, because he had never worked with anyone who cared so much about every choice that they were making as director. And I believe he said that, and I don't think he was joking when he said it. I'm laughing because it's intense. But I think he said that each choice felt like someone's life was on the line.
Oh, my goodness.
Do you feel that way when you're on set?
Oh, well, the choices have to be performed very quickly, right? So when you don't feel like you've had time to contemplate something fully, you know, you feel like there's almost more risk associated with the idea that you're not thinking it through completely, but you have to decide right now, and you could feel regret, but nonetheless you've got to decide right now. And so I think possibly in the mix of what he's just of what he said is that notion that you have to almost take a deep breath, close your eyes, and say, like, okay, I'm taking this gamble, you know. And of course, thank goodness no one's life is really on the line. But the fact is, I think deciding all day long in a rapid succession of decisions can start to feel like the starkness. Am I on the right track? Have I made the right decisions? And I think maybe what he's reading in me is that uncertainty that feels like, yikes, I could be wasting a whole lot of people's time. If I'm making a whole set of decisions that don't pan out and don't yield something, I've just squandered a huge amount of people's time and energy, and they're putting a lot into this. I've got to do right by them, you know? So I think frequently a director feels extremely responsible for coming through with something, given that so many people are contributing to the process and the effort.
I feel like a lot of people have an idea of what a director does that is, or maybe how a director is, that might be fundamentally misogynist. And I would probably include myself in that. Mm. Like, when I think of a director, not only do I probably think of a man, but I also think of somebody who has a way of being in the world that culturally I would associate with men, which is to say, like, bossing people around, especially.
Mm. Well, yeah.
And you're talking about the same process in a very different way. And I imagine you must be aware of the way that that has affected the way people see you as a director and the way that that has affected your career. Is that true? Like, do you feel like there is a world of people who want you to be somebody who makes pronouncements?
For centuries, I think we've wondered whether there was a correlation between certain kinds of mania or certain kinds of erratic behavior or eccentricities and the notion of genius, which is a very complicated term in itself. And at times we know that's really been true, right? I mean, I think someone who stands out is the embodiment of that is like Isaac Newton, you know. The many people that never slept or, you know, someone like Gramsci, you know, people for whom even just sort of bodily comforts and you know, basic needs of the body sort of were ignored and the hours at which they toiled and the way in which their thoughts would never cease for them and that the that things would come at them so fast and furious. You know, that's a very specific notion. But then we grew up with this other kind of notion that to be non-negotiable, to scream over people, to be so rarefied. You know, I think people started performing this idea of the exotic genius. It became performative. Or it was there was OCD involved and it was unchecked and there was permission given. Oh, he's a genius. He can roll over people or he's a genius. He can scream and shout. He's a genius. He can pound the table and break the glass. He's a genius. He can sort of order everyone in the film to cry. He can order their clothes off, you know. He can compromise them. He can humiliate them, you know. And I think that we are really calling times up on that behavior. And, you know, I'm not going to ever say that – I would never say that no woman can – perpetrate that. Of course they can. You know, this is a behavior, not a gender. You know, this is a behavior. And I just think that there was so much pressure on men to be so stellar that then they had to perform this jacked up genius routine, you know, which basically was bad behavior. So I think it is complicated. I think women are capable of it. And, you know, so please, I hope I'm getting this across. Please, Deborah, you know, get this across, which is, you know, it's not pitting men against women in this case. It's that we formatted and promulgated an ideal of that genius meant tempestuous. And I am a tempestuous person, so let me not say that you didn't have to take responsibility for your tempestuousness. I am tempestuous, and I take huge responsibility. I can't always correct it. I can't always modify it. But afterwards, I sure as experience regret, you know, if I've done wrong by people, you know.
Deborah, are you still developing a feature film based on Nickeled and Dimed, the best-selling first-person journalism / sociology book by Barbara Ehrenreich?
Yes. Yes, we are. We are working on a script of that is... So we're doing a fictional adaptation of that sociological book, and the next phase will be to take the script to hopefully New Jersey. Hopefully, New Jersey will be the post-industrial and very rich home for this tale to be told. And her book has never lost its relevance, you know. And in fact, what she was calling the minimum wage now, as you know, is often referred to as the poverty wage. So it's, I think, in some ways, what she laid the groundwork for has become an utterly incisive and continuously evolving analysis. And to me, it's so indicative that every few years she has to change the foreword, you know, the preface. She has to update it because the book is still in play big time. And she notes the crimes against poor people just keep proliferating. Like, what? No one thought it would continue. Why would once you breach this fundamental agreement and then start to find other ways to further nickel and dime working people, you know, it's quite sinister, honestly.
What made you think that you could make a narrative film out of it? I mean, I remember reading you talking about reading the book that became Leave No Trace and seeing immediately the, you know, the way that the way that the trees look on camera, you know?
Yeah. Yes. And are you asking, like, what is visual in her book?
It seems so gutsy to me to make a feature film out of this book. It was a book I read when it was new, and I really enjoyed it and felt like I learned and got a lot out of it. But I also, at the time, wouldn't have been, like, you know, chomping a cigar and being like, green light in the room, let's make a film out of this.
Yeah, and believe me, there's not too much of that. That green light is extremely... it's hard won, and that would be really about a very, very, I want to say, so indispensably important kind of financier right now that, you know, there's only one out of many hundreds of thousands who can say, I can work with a slow return, and my objective is much more impact than profit. And that's the kind of financier that would be needed for the telling of a tale that, like you said, that is very, very much the day-to-day of how to get by in a service economy that is itself very destabilized and in many places sort of rolling up, you know, like that. Changes happen in a way that in this era, it's the speed. We just don't have time to turn around. What does it mean for brick and mortar to disappear, you know, to become scarce? You know, I think that wasn't anyone's playbook, you know? And so I think Barbara's book will be it will be very rich to marry it to what, you know, what's happening now. And I think what's won my heart is that I want the families in that story to get what they need. I want them to be able to find a way for them to be adept and non-destroyed guardians for their children. You know, I want them to find lyrical moments. I want them to find things that enrich their lives. I want them to have good moments, even if there's not a budget in their extremely frugal existence. They'll make it somehow. You know, so I want to see the anthropology of scrappy survival. And her book loves on those people, you know. It was a way in which she cataloged the nobility of what it takes to actually be able to function in the contemporary wage labor world.
Well, Deborah, I'm so grateful that you took all this time to come be on Bullseye. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Well, thank you for your soulful questions and, you know, willingness to contemplate so many diverse things.
Deborah Granick, one of the smartest people I've ever heard talk about film, and I mean that for real, and I've talked to a lot of people about film. Leave No Trace is absolutely stunning. You can buy it or stream it online now. Go see it. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org world headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park, in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where just yesterday there was a crane so huge that it stretched far beyond our ninth floor window. We think it was lifting elevator parts into our building. I mean, it was truly gargantuan. I cannot overstate how huge this crane was or how weird it was to see it power up in front of our, you know, in front of our big picture windows. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellow is Shayna Deloria. Our interstitial music, the music you are hearing right now and in between segments and so forth, comes from DJW, aka the great Dan Wally, the world's handsomest record collector. Thanks for sharing it with us, Dan. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It's by the band The Go Team. They and their label Memphis Industries provided it to us. Our thanks go to both of them. And before you go, I have been making this show for over 15 years, coming up on 20 years since I was in college. And I have interviewed so many hundreds of people, and almost every single episode that we have ever recorded is archived on our website at MaximumFun.org. You can also find our recent interviews on YouTube, where they are easy to play and share. Everybody knows how to watch a video on YouTube, right? You can also find them on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at Bullseye. Or just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You will find all of those things and plenty of stuff to listen to. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
Support for NPR comes from ADP. Say you're in HR and a solar flare adds an extra hour to each day. How would this impact business? ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to help your business take on the next anything. ADP, always designing for people.
On this week's episode of Wildcard, actor Chris Pine tells us it's okay not to be perfect.
My film got absolutely decimated when it premiered, which brings up for me one of my primary triggers or whatever is like not being liked.
I'm Rachel Martin. Chris Pine on how to find joy in imperfection. That's on NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation.